little slaves. It keeps them in poverty. So we do, we do what we can to help, and everybody's a little different, and we treat people as individuals, and what they want is determined by them. What success is determined by them.
Well, thanks for giving those specific examples, because that just shows basically the whole kind of rabbit hole or myriad of needs for people when they're getting out and what that looks like. And Trish, again, thanks so much for all the great work that you're doing, and always looking forward to having y'all back on and getting all these great updates. And people should always check out Red Lodge Transition Services. It's redlodgetransition.org is the website. And you've been listening to Prison Pipeline, airing from the studios of KBOO Portland. Listen to this and previous Prison Pipeline programs at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. Like Prison Pipeline on Facebook. Special thanks to our amazing guest and a Prison Pipeline Collective member, Karen James.
Thanks for listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM in the Portland metro area and all over the world at KBOO.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. KBOO's Board of Directors meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 0.
Never been done before.
We're talking about a subject.
To bring you to the light.
Farewell to you, people.
Hold up. Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. All year, we've been making it a point to talk with movers and shakers, freedom fighters, people who have astute analysis, and in this case, has written a book and has been on our show for a number of years and has been telling us, like our friend Kali Akuno, these days are coming. In fact, our guests pretty much told us how it would show up and what the reaction would be. Fortunately for her, she's prepared, but she's here to share with us some more analysis because her freedom fighting has not stopped. It is Professor Tina Bell Wright. What do you have in the back of your thing? Cooperation?
Cooperative Economic Empowerment Movement. It's one of the co-ops that I'm a member of, but I'm on this board. It's a Black co-op in Southern California. And thank you for having me again, Dave.
Right. Also the author of 360 Degrees, Blueprint. Give the full title.
360 Degrees, A Blueprint to Black Self-Determination.
So let's start with those two. You have this co-op. You've been talking about co-ops for a long time. We often have Kali and Kuno on, but we could also have you on because you all be going to these co-op things.
Sure.
How important is it to be a part of a co-op at this moment in time with fascism in full bloom? People keep saying it's on its way, but
It's here.
Right.
Yeah, I think it's critically important because it's not only creating and being part of a community that can help take care of itself during all of these situations. But it's really cultural shifting too. You know, it's moving away from, you know, the capitalism model we've been dealing with and the really undemocratic society we've been living in, and having values that really center those things like democracy, one member, one vote. Yes, taking care of material needs and can be, you know, a business, but it's shared. It's not all going to the top CEO 100, 200, 300% and workers getting nothing. Instead, you have worker-owned businesses, you have cooperatives where the profits are shared, and it's a cultural shift that is needed if we're going to be able to survive.
We're hardwired, many of us, to hoard and get as much as we can. So as you're sitting there talking, I'm saying to myself, maybe I can join this co-op. And if I do, I might be able to get some extra gigs and I could get some things. And so you bring to this a capitalist mindset, and some of it may be actually very detrimental because, you know, this one, I like to think I'm benevolent. Like, you know, I just want enough to be comfortable and to eat and share. But others are like, nah, get rid of your competition at all costs. How do you get this mind shift for people to really come into a program like this where they do follow the tenets and respect the values?
It's not easy, Davey. I'll be honest with you. It's a paradigm shift. And like you said, some people come in with the idea of what can I get out of it instead of understanding the power of collectivity and building together. So it is absolutely not easy. It is cultural, meaning there's a lot of unlearning that, you know, miseducating and unlearning that has to be done in order for you really to benefit from it. And it is about, you know, yes, we all have some self-centering that we do in terms of survival and whatever, but we also need to understand that we are social beings. None of us can make it through this world alone, and start kind of acting accordingly.
Are we at a point, Professor Wright, where there's a point of no return for some people, and we're now just going to have to accept the fact that some people can't be a part of the tribe?
Absolutely.
Some people, you say that without hesitation. And you have said that before, but it seems like there's a lot of time being spent to get people to a point where they can function in a way that's going to be healthy. And some people, I'm finding it's a habit they don't want to. Others have been paid to be disruptive. And at the same time, you're battling with the fact like, hey, I love my people, I love my community, and we got to go through it, we got to stick it out. Where do you draw the line on that, especially at times like this where me bringing my A game and you bringing your A game to collective operation is imperative?
I draw the line at I will share and build with anyone until it becomes a waste of my time, or I realize quickly that they're not about that life, right? And so I move on. I don't like harp on it. I don't like try to, this Eastern philosophy saying when the student is ready, the teacher appears. If the student's not ready, it doesn't matter what you do and what you say and what you teach, they're not going to quite get it. And so I've kind of taken that philosophy. And people are not ready for a lot of different reasons, you know? So I also don't like, I don't take offense or take it personally or, you know, wish that people would be different. I accept it and I continue to build what I'm building with the people that also want to build the same and put my energy in that.
We both teach. And one of the lessons that I'm constantly harping on with students are twofold. One is the gaslighting that society has put on them. And the gaslighting says, I did it myself. You know, it's a rugged individualism. But behind the scenes, they're networked and queued up and posse'd up in the whole nine. And I mean, we see this playing out in this fascism thing, right? Who do you know?
Right.
You know, let me look out. Let me bring Elon in, and Elon's going to bring him in. And all those people operating together while they're telling us it's an individual thing. And so that's one thing. The other thing is that trying to get people to understand the importance of bringing their A game to every situation, when a lot of people are like, they're still trying to cut corners. And we're seeing that play out, because we're seeing some very mediocre people.
Right.
In some very powerful positions. And what happens when they're cutting corners, it is having a detrimental effect on all of society right now.
Yeah, no, I think you're right in terms of your first point. I say it as the power structure, the power elite, know and understand social and behavioral sciences better than the average person, if you will, and social structure built on connections and who you know and network and all of those things. And so I had the benefit of, when I was in graduate school, working with one of the prominent people in social network analysis. And that's when I learned the lesson about structure built off of connections and networks and power, and how power is built that way. And so I wrote a whole book about it. Yes, I did. And so you're right that they will sell everyone else a lie and to keep basically the game going. But all what they have is either built on, you know, people's back, other people's labor, people's back. And then they hoard it and between their connections of the very few elite. And so, yes, you're absolutely right about that.
How do you start to break these habits? You know, walk us through, like, you have a co-op. What does that look like in terms of, you know, people coming to the table and moving, you know, forward with a particular project or mission?
Right. One of the things that I tell my class and that I outlined in the book too is, you know, there's multiple steps you can take, but one is just join an organization, join a group, which is outside of your family friend network, right? So people of like minds that want to build something together. Once you get involved with an organization and group like that, you will be able to see the benefit of it and start to see kind of a bigger picture of how you can have an effect on society. And so I think that's the first thing. If you're not a part of some organization, some cooperative, some, you know, social justice group, something that is moving our community forward, that's where you start.
They used to say, find a good church home.
Right.
And I didn't get that until I got older. Like, a church home is not any church.
No, it's not.
Go to many until you find one that you're comfortable. You might be into, you know, the singing and, you know, and that type of thing. So go to that. Others, you know, you want social justice in the forefront. You want somebody who's like, let me give you the scripture, but let me talk about it. And you go to that. But they said it's really important to find that church home, because for the same reasons you can build. And I guess for what I'm hearing, you're saying we got to find that organizational home.
And you're right. Not all are going to be a good fit. You know, not all are going to be a good fit, but go around and go to meetings, go to different events, go to things, and then, you know, sign up to different listservs and whatever, and find your organizational home that you can build with. And that will make a big difference. And if we all do that, it would make a huge difference.
So you said find a good home. What's the next steps, you know, in the cooperative situation? What do we need to kind of understand?
I mean, one of the big things is we have to work on kind of the cultural building trust, because we, you know, have been taught, as you said, and miseducated to trust liars and gaslighters and not believe our own experience. So, you know, one of my favorites, James Baldwin, always says, you know, don't believe anyone, including me, just trust your experience, right? And so I want people to really start to believe more in themselves, get healthier in terms of their mind and focus and sharpness, be able to discern when they're being lied to and not, just have a really more sharp focus on the fact that, you know, yeah, you can't believe everything and everybody. And the ones that you have been taught to, that's all been a lie. So if we're going to trust people that probably have had the same experience as you, that you have, and that you can build with. And so that is one of the things. The other thing, though, is to really be honest. I don't think enough people are honest. And this is why, Davey, maybe I was early on saying, yeah, no, not in this country. We're not going to see what we want to see. And this is probably what's going to happen instead, because I have made an honest assessment of a good amount of people in this country and why they are the way they are and what they have gotten in terms of a benefit on a coin with two sides. They're standard of living, their privilege, their, you know, lied to as well in terms of getting things for out of a racial order, but all of those things. And so, you know, do the homework and have a honest assessment of what you're dealing with is really important.
How do you know it's an honest assessment?
Well, history can teach us a lot, right? And so when you really study history and understand history, you'll start to see patterns. And those patterns will lead you to factual understandings of things, you know, because, yeah, there is, you know, in sociology, we talk about subjective reality versus objective. And we all have our own subjective reality based on the time, space, place we live in. Our understanding of the world is very much based on those things, but there are facts, there are social facts in this world that if you go and look through history and see how patterns play out, you can start to discern those.
You know, we were kind of talking a little bit offline and just remarking how many of the people that we teach on the collegiate level no longer read. And I'm saying to myself, how does that happen? Right. And it's an across the board thing,
yes,
right?
Yes.
I mean, you can attest there are meetings that they have at these colleges, like, how do I get my students to read?
Yes,
you
know, I can attest.
I bring this up because part of what led to it was obviously the fact that we all are looking for instant gratification.
Right.
I need it quick, fast, in a hurry. But there seemed to be an amplification and a highlighting and even a rewarding of anti-intellectualism, right? We see it in the most grotesque form where you have somebody say fake news and they burn books and things like that. But you also have a lot of people in our own community that will look you dead in the face and go, I know you've been doing this 30 years, but you know what? You know, I don't believe you. I don't believe your work.
Right.
And it's like, brother, I did 30 years. Yeah, well, you did your work for the man. You know, I'm going to do my own research, and their research is going to an apparatus like YouTube that actually will filter and
consciously call that research.
Yeah, yeah. But you're talking about a machine that will go, huh, let me take some of these things and make it almost impossible to reach.
Yeah.
Right. Let's remove this and let's amplify certain things. And so you have people with a lot of false information.
Yes.
That they swear is the honest to God truth. And they're building off that.
Yeah.
They're building off that as we are seeing these touch points of experience are systemically being removed. So a lot of us had stuff that we did with the Smithsonian. That's being removed.
Right.
Right. We have friends that were working in libraries and all that being removed and disappeared. And it's making me wonder how people, well, first of all, do people know what was taken? And two, how will we even get it all back?
So no, not everyone does know that it was taken because they're not tuned in. That is one of, you know, that's textbook fascism, right? Uneducated, you know, mass that doesn't have you know, access to knowledge and information, and only comes through the state. And so those are the reasons why. I do believe that you're correct, that there is some, and it maybe is just because of how technology has moved us forward so quickly, but there are folks that believe they can just, you know, go to Google or whatever and find out information, and then make the mistake of believing everything they see at the top of this search. And so that's why one of the tenets of my book is media literacy, because I think folks need to understand how to be literate about media as well as everything else. I do think that, you know, you were in that documentary, a hip hop documentary a long time ago, Letter to the President or something, where someone talked about how lyrics weren't as good as they used to be. And it's because people don't read anymore. So, you know, they're not writing as well because they don't have as much kind of basis to put it to use in their writings. And the anti-intellectualism is real. I mean, I've seen really scary videos, quite honestly, where people, you know, of the cult are just, you know, DEI, you know, black, basically, but DEI. And then when they're asked what it is, they can't even say what D stands for, E stands for, or I stands for, or what any of them mean. And so it is part of the plan, quite honestly. And the way we have to combat it, especially within our community, is the same as it's always been. FUBU, we teach ourselves, we make sure we pass down stories and history. Cannot, you know, not share what we know with next generations coming. So, you know, this is why you and I are both in education. These are the ways that we'll have to do it when the state apparatus is not going to do it, or when they're trying to close down libraries, or when they're trying to do this or that. That's what we have to do for ourselves. So, you know, one of the quotations from Carter G. Woodson that I always go back to is where he says, you know, it doesn't matter who's in power, folks that haven't learned to do for themselves, I want to get it exactly right. So history shows that it does not matter who is in power or what revolutionary forces take over the government. Those who have not learned to do for themselves and have to depend solely on others never obtain any more rights or privileges in the end than they had in the beginning. And so it comes back to self-determination.
You know, if you were talking, a couple of things came to mind. One is looking at the way that we have to now be media literate. So let me give an example. Actually, two. I went to a AI conference the other day, last week, and it was dealing with journalists and how that plays out. And the good people from Google were there, you know, people that were, you know. And one of the things that I brought up was like, their presence and what they amplify and choose not to amplify on, you know, their search engine has altered the way that people will actually tell a story. So let's say I'm going to do a story on your history, but the Google word of the day is in format is that I got to have 300 words, can't have more than 5,000 words. I got to have links. I got to have all these different things just to show up in a search engine, and I got to have some colorful words and a colorful title. So if I want to go, you know, Professor Wright is a freedom fighter who, you know, checks the police, right? But their thing is like, there's no, you know, that they won't have,
right?
They want control. Me to say something, they want me to say a whole other different thing, right? So all of a sudden, let's say their Google word or whatever is apples. So all of a sudden I'm trying to talk about some very serious thing and then insert the word apple in the story so it can show up, right? You know, it's all this manipulation.
Right.
And that's not even counting what happens with the AI stuff, which makes it even more difficult. The other thing you mentioned, Letter to the President, and this is connected because that came out maybe 15, 20 years before we get into this DEI stuff.
Right.
And when we shot that, I took Thomas Gibson, who is the director, and we were in L.A. And we did like an hour-long interview with Jim Brown. He was talking about what it took to get the Gang Truth together. We sat mm-hmm. down with Angela Davis. I mean, we did interviews with everybody.
Right.
When they went to bring this for to be, at that time, I think it was Blockbuster,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yes.
They said, we will not put this on our shelves because nobody knows who this Jim Brown or Angela Davis is.
Right.
You know, all these people we had in there. And they literally gave a list. And now that list was 50 Cent, Ja Rule, Jada
right.
Kiss, right? All these artists that were popping at the time said, put those people in there so we can distribute it, you know? And so they went back because, you know, a lot of money was laid out and they need to, you know, at this point, make sure it's going to show, it gets distributed.
Right.
So I'm watching a Jim Brown interview where he's like, this is how we were able to get the gangs to sit down. And all of a sudden it's like, so they came to my house. And then we have 50 Cent. Man, I got shot 9 times. And, you know, and I'm going to, you know, right, I'm going to get right. my revenge. And then it's his Angela Davis speaking eloquently, only to be like with Jadakiss. And these, not to say these people are bad, but it had no context
right.
to what they were saying.
Right.
But we, you know, I saw them have to do it. So people to this day, they go, oh, it's a good film. I hate it because I saw all the stuff that was taken out.
Right.
I know
you saw how it was edited.
And I know what's missing,
right,
from
right.
it. And that's the fear that I have now, that we have all this stuff that has been removed. You know,
I mean,
you
were talking, yeah,
you
I'm
were
sorry.
Talking about, as you were talking about the cooperative economics and all the things that were going on, I was thinking about Maroons. And you and a few people have talked about it, but man, those things, they're not in the books no more. You can't find these movies. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like
yes.
you don't even know what that's even about at this time or even when it's coming from. Because now you hear people go, who the hell are these Jamaicans? What, you know, they don't even, and it's like, don't you know their
the history, right? No, and for this right now in this country, understanding and knowing how Maroons operated is critical. Okay.
Yeah.
I say, like, within the power structure, you have to, that's kind of what cooperatives can do in this power structure, is kind of act like Maroons.
Yeah.
Act like Maroons. And so the one of the things that COOPSEAM has is our own social platform. So one, to get off these billionaires, so stop giving them our connections and our stories and our data and so on. But two, because of control. Basically, you know, like, you know, in 360, I say take an assessment of what do you control and what don't you control, because that's basically as at how self-determined you are. Power as control. And so, you know, when we're dealing with, like you said, someone who has the control to tell you to take things in and put other things in and take other things out, that is what you are dealing with. And so when you have the control, or your community has the control, or people you build with and trust have the control, then you make those decisions. And that's what mm-hmm. makes all the difference.
Real talk, at this point in time, where do you see things headed? You know, what is glaring for you right now? You know, just starting out, what do you think? Let's start off with Black folks.
Okay.
What do you think we are up against? Because I'm still seeing amplified on my feed every day, people holding cups of coffee and saying, this ain't my problem. And I'm like,
right. I mean, and I get it. Like, Black folks in particular have taken a very interesting stand as a collective in this fall of empire, like, you know, drinking their coffee while everything burns around them, or dancing their line dance while everything burns around them. And honestly, I get it. I do hope, though, that they are organizing on the community level and have their group that they can go to when, for example, some kind of social services, like they don't get a social security check anymore, happens, or when they cut Medicaid. And so what is your plan for that? You know, all jokes aside, knowing the things that you actually need to depend on, including maybe your job in a situation where you have, you know, an erratic narcissist who will break an economy for no other reason, but he just talks too much and off the top of his head. You have to have a plan. So I understand Black people not wanting to be on the front line anymore. Been there, done that, tried to tell you a million times, you know.
But are the people holding that coffee and this is my thing. Have you really been on the front line? Because there's a lot of people that are holding cups of coffee never marched.
Yeah.
That never participated, that never put in the work like somebody like yourself. And that's when I'm like, wait, what do you mean?
No, it's fair. It's fair. Yeah. Some have, some absolutely haven't. But as you well know, they're, you know, click chasing as well. And that's their hustle now, is trying to get likes and stuff on whatever their social media platform is. And so that is absolutely fair. But they will, like you said, I have a plan and I've been working up my plan and putting it together and so on. If they don't have a plan, they're going to be caught flat-footed. And so my hope is, and you know what I'm also trying to do, is inform folks and give them opportunities for a plan and whatnot. And folks that will listen and want to build, I'm spending a lot of time and am tired doing it, and you know, to help out others. But folks that don't, you know, I will wait and see. But they need a plan, because we're living in very erratic times. I don't know what will be of, you know, this specific society, but I do know that things are being exposed, which is good. Like, for example, I have, for the first time, you know, how much Fox News and the right has vilified Marx, Marxism, all of that kind of talk. I can go online now and hear all these conversations about means of production and modes of production and things like that were not being talked about before. And so there's some things that people are learning in terms of things like class consciousness, alienation, and important ideas that they're not learning in the schools, unless they're taking like one of our classes, and they're not learning in regular mainstream media. And so there is opportunity. But you have to have a plan. You have to have a plan and work a plan, and you have to have a group to support you.
The plan that I think is going to be enacted is a sinister one. We laughed at the South African ran up into these offices and took everybody's data.
Right.
And now that he has everybody's data, maybe we'll just garnish Professor Wright's wages. And
I mean,
say
that's
that,
what they're saying.
Yeah.
They're even saying that about the student loans. They're going to be garnishing wages. Yep.
Right. Without a court order, without anything. So you just come there and all of a sudden it's like, you owe $10 million, but I don't. But now there's no government agency
exactly
to actually protect you. So we're now in a situation where it can be very precarious. You can be on, as you see, a no-fly list.
Right.
Or, you know, or
just stopped at the border, or just disappeared overnight with no kind of due process. All of that is happening.
And so the infrastructure is gone. And I don't think people have fully planned for that. I think I see two reactions to it. One, I see many people saying, well, it can't be this bad. Like, they're in disbelief.
Right.
And history says to me that that's how it was in other places when fascism was blowing up. When we talked to people in Chile, they were like, yeah, business went on as usual. Then maybe you just didn't see a friend, but it was no big announcement that we're here. They just started, you know, doing stuff. And then you would hear, you know, later down the road. And I think we're at that moment where people are like, no way this has happened. I'm going, man, they garnish your wages. So, you know, now you can go, California, they're not falling in line. So why don't we just enforce this student loan stuff just on people who have a Golden State zip code? Because you know what? They won't know that we gave a break to everybody in Alabama. You see what I'm saying?
Exactly.
So those are the type of shenanigans. Or, you know, maybe we'll just, you know, put chalk in the milk in their state.
Right.
And there's
no
federal.
I see it completely.
Yeah.
Completely.
So how do we plan for that? It seems like you plan because you're producing your own stuff.
Right. So that is one of the things. You produce your own stuff. One of SEEM's things is backyard farming. That's one of our initiatives. Mm-hmm. Backyard farming, community gardens, you know, things that we can produce for ourselves, take care of ourselves, have a federation of folks that can work together to deal with in case of any of these things happening. And then, you know, I have a exit strategy as well. And, you know, would hope other people have something that they can do within whatever their means are as well.
When you say exit strategy, what do you mean?
Well, my exit strategy is, you know, I bought property outside of this country. I have, you know, enough cash to get across any place if I need to, like, you know, bribe someone to get across somewhere if it gets to that point, and then I have somewhere else I can go. But for those that are living here, you have to think about possibly off-grid, because maybe you don't have access to, you know, what if something happens to your utilities, so on and so forth. You need to figure out groups you can work with that you can build things under solar. You know, all these are really important plans to make, but have to be made in groups, with people, in organization. And so, you know, whatever yours is, you should try to think about what happens if I don't get my pension after I've been working 20 something years for, because it is absolutely a possibility.
Because they manipulated the data.
Right.
Changed it around and said, there's no record of you
exactly,
working for 25
exactly.
years.
So you have to have your, you know, you have to think of what if any of these things can happen. Not that they, you know, it may not. So for example, you know, my aunt just came back from, she's a permanent resident card holder and went to, and in Jamaica, came back from there. And, you know, I had to get numbers for people she knew in high places in case she got stopped at the border. And, you know, you have to have a plan. I told people when I go back and forth, I'm not turning over a phone, but what I am going to do is have a few numbers in my head and let you know, so they'll know if they don't hear from me, they've disappeared me and start to make noise, you know. So you have to have a plan.
Real talk. You know, we've been talking with Professor Tina Bell Wright. Teaching right now, have you all been hit with the type of policies? How has that shown up for, you know, for your peers and where you're at?
So we have been hit, but not as bad as some places. And, you know, we had meetings, and I've talked to people as well, because Colombia set a terrible precedent. Okay, and I'm glad to see that others are not. And I saw UCLA fell in line too, and others, you know, that shouldn't have fell in line, that basically will sell you Black folks out, Black brown folks out, you know, working class folks out to keep our money. And so, you know, now hopefully folks will realize that these institutions really never cared about us and again, act accordingly and plan accordingly. So yeah, there's budget issues, of course. On the AI thing, I don't even know if you've been dealing with this, but our district in particular have been dealing with tons of AI bots in our classes that have also affected our funding and bottom line. So we're at both the federal issues and like technology issues.
So with the bots, there's a couple of things that I know that have happened. And the latest one was that they would show up as false enrollments. So were you dealing with that aspect of it?
Yes.
Can you explain to people how that was coming up? You know,
it's very crazy, because it also, they, you know, it's part of kind of a financial aid hustle, if you will, or scam. But, you know, they get an ID, they get username, they send you an email, I'd like to enroll. They all look the same. Okay. And then many of them are able to get enrolled. And then you have to do certain type of exercises to make sure and prove that they're real people, because many of them are not. And so you end up having to drop, you know, the bots, and then you end up with a class that started at 40 and ends with 10.
Right.
But and then you have a lot of students that are real students that couldn't get in.
Right. It not only could they get in, but I heard some of those bots were also collecting money and financial aid.
That's exactly right.
Wow. So, again, this is a point where people have to adapt.
Yes.
Stay on top of things.
I'm glad you used the word adapt, because I do think that's another thing. We need to tap into nature and what we can learn from, you know, nature, and adaptation is one of the big lessons from nature, if you will. And so, yeah, we need to know, have honest assessments, adapt, plan, etc.
As we close out, I want you to take a moment and highlight a couple of things in your book, you know, that you haven't talked about that folks should really hone in on, that right now at this moment are absolutely applicable in 360 degrees blueprint for self-determination.
Well, we talked about a lot, but I will go back to the maroon aspect, because I think that's really important. Because I think when we're honest about where our power is versus, you know, state power, military, hoarding of all the wealth and so on, we need to take an honest assessment of what people power can best do in these times. And so I do think we need to study maroons, understand it as a strategy of both defense and building, and you know, look to history. And so I do think that folks were taken by surprise. You know, you and I were not, because right. We've been talking about it for years. But I think some folks were taken by surprise. Oh, this couldn't happen here. This always has happened here. And so when you know history, you know that not only can it has and has been, it's just which people have been affected, right?
And right. So, and when you're not intentional about knowing history, you can literally sit there and go, that ain't happened, and not know about the systemic genocide that took place with indigenous folks.
Absolutely.
Right? Where
absolutely.
You can see all that play out. People right. being disappeared. People,
right.
You know, I
right.
mean, people being decimated and destroyed. People
right.
being demonized.
Yep.
You know, and being destroyed wholesale. And then being gaslit, where we actually remember there was a time that people would celebrate cowboys and Indians.
Yeah.
Right? And
yeah.
So, I mean, that is the equivalent to, you know, saying slave master and slave.
Exactly.
I want to be the slave master.
Right.
I mean, you might as well just say that, because if you don't have that history, then yeah you forget.
You can believe that this is all a surprise. It hasn't happened before, and it has. And so, yeah, I absolutely believe that, you know, libraries are still free and they are still open many places. And so utilize libraries, the internet, you know, making sure you know and check sources and go, you know, use media literacy skills in order to, you know, look at what is real, what's not, discern information and so on. But it's not because you don't have access to information. It is because what will you do with that information? And are you just kind of absorbing but not building and that kind of thing? So continue to build, join some organization.
You know, one thing I think we need to be clear about is that the notion of state has expanded. So we're thinking like the state, but the state is now Mark Zuckerberg. The state is now Elon Musk and tech billionaires. That's the state now, because in these dictatorships, right, the way that they've been able to carry out historically is that there's a state and private partnership.
Right.
And we're seeing, you know, today we might call them oligarchs,
right?
But big institutions, you know, can now do the dirty work.
Yes.
You know, I think we were talking about Target the other day, how Target has an incredible surveillance system, and they train police to use their crime lab and all this other stuff. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, Target, you know, can, you know, they have all this technology, they do all this face recognition, all kind of crazy stuff that the state might
right.
not have been able to do, but them as a private institution, you know, not
yeah.
only can do, they have done. And
right.
then that, and then those institutions can share it with the state,
right.
as we're seeing, you know, groups like
they
Canary Mission
power.
And other, you know. And
right.
so we have to see collaborators with the state.
Yeah.
The state.
I mean, that's why, like I said, I, you know, I'm going to continue to try to build and get people off all those billionaire platforms and onto platforms like Seem Social to divest from those. But yeah, I'm glad you brought up those private industries and people and billionaires and so on, because for me, and I've been saying it more and more, if we're not talking about power, then we're not talking. I don't want to talk to you. If you're not talking about power, who has it, how they got it, how we build it, and so on. That's really what we all should be focused on at this point.
There you have it. A strong note to end on. Professor Tina Bell Wright, how do we get a hold of you?
You know what? Let me just throw my email address out there. And from there, anyone who wants to email, I can share my link tree, which has all the different organizations that I'm a part of. So you can find me at tina@utn360.org. Tina, T-I-N-A, @utn360.org.
There you have it. We're going to take a break on Hard Knock Radio. We'll be right back.
Hard Knock, turn the speakers in your car up. Quality program, turn in for the real talk. Don't stop, EMN at it again. Sandman, Daddy Man, Chris Juwan, Cam, yeah. Innovation, stimulating ill conversation. Anything else, just imitation, simulation. Step into the zone, the Bay Area zone. Hard Knock Radio, let's go. Big shout out to Nita and Davey D. Yeah, right, feel me. Yeah. Honing down at Hard Knock Radio.
Hard Knock Radio.
Kinda crazy though. Oakland, stand up.
Stand up.
Ensemble, Big Night Wolves.
Yeah. Kansas City.
Yeah. Yeah.
Bellevue. Come on. Check out.
Why every novice think they hard knock when they ain't going all in and ain't paid the cost of the fee? Hating that they made they beats, trying to eat till they're ready for the steel crate. Beats, they bleed. Maybe they'll save you a seat at the table with a great bread making a speech. Say some peace to their lovers, I name with a please. Maybe some shade on your name in the street.
Real Talk Radio.
You are now rocking with the best in the West.
Yes, Coast. Monday through Friday.
Sing it, Chris.
East Coast. Dance
out. You know, even though I didn't know.
The rain falls hard. An old man sleeps, no roof, no guard. Under the freeway, lost in cold. Somebody's father left out alone. What mother could picture this sight? Her child forgotten, lost to the night. $1 billion homes lying the way, but for him there's no shelter, no place to stay. What happens to us when we fall from grace?
Fall from grace.
When the world turns its back. Why do the evil people never ever die?
Die.
While the good ones suffer and ask the sky,
sky.
Is there no justice for the ones who cry? Will we ever rise? Will we ever thrive?
Sky.
As this old man shivers in the dead of night,
die.
Rich people passing their lives full of life, they turn a blind eye, too busy to care, while he's left to freeze in the cold, cold air. people never ever die. While the good ones suffer and ask the sky, is there no justice for the ones who cry? Will we ever rise? Will we ever thrive? Why do evil people keep on living? Why so many who are good keep forgiving? One day, someday, things got to change. We can't keep suffering. We can't remain the same.
The power of black music. Music is far more than a multi-billion dollar business in the U.S. and around the world. It is far more than the stuff that comes out of your radio in an unending roll. For some people, music, the right music, can transform one's way of looking at the world and even change lives. By music, as you may have guessed, I'm not talking about bubblegum pop or rap. I'm talking about a music form that has been called classical, at least by black listeners, for generations. I speak of jazz. I speak specifically of the music of the late saxophonist John Coltrane, born 1926, died 1967, an adherent of the form that came to be called avant-garde, French for advance-garde or free-form jazz. In the 50s, he was a star player in the Miles Davis Quintet. Later, he would lead several groups, and when not zonked out high on heroin, would play such music as would move millions, even now, decades after his death. In San Francisco, a church stands today which has named the musician a saint of the African Orthodox Rite. This is the same church that was a religious branch of the Marcus Garvey Black Nationalist Movement of the early 20th century. At the St. John Will.i.am Coltrane African Orthodox Church, Archbishop Franzo Wayne King presides, and his appreciation of Coltrane's music may be shown as often by his preaching as by his playing of the saxophone in tribute to the saint. In a recent interview, Archbishop King explained that he heard Coltrane live in 1966 at a local club called the Jazz Workshop, where he and his girlfriend, soon-to-be wife Marina, got front-row seats. What they heard that evening almost literally blew him away. King would later explain the experience as his sound baptism. So taken was he by the power and beauty of Coltrane's music that he first organized a small congregation called the Yardbird Temple, named after the nickname of another famous sax player, Charlie Parker. In this initial gathering, Coltrane was worshipped as a god, and Parker was seen as a John the Baptist type figure. Years later, when he joined the African Orthodox Church, Coltrane was demoted to saint. Today, people come from all around the world to visit the San Francisco church. The influence of Coltrane has also had far less spectacular but still meaningful impact on the lives of people during the 60s. As black revolutionary and later scholar Muhammad Ahmad, who worked with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, the Revolutionary Action Movement, and other such movements, would later write in his political autobiography, "We Will Return in the Whirlwind," music opened his mind to political ideas and possibilities. First was going to see Max Roach and Abby Lincoln present their Freedom Now suite at the National Convention of the NAACP, which was held in Philadelphia that year. I had been raised on jazz and had done my homework with Eddie Collier while listening to John Coltrane's Giant Steps. I had gone to the Newport Jazz Festival and was an avid fan of both Miles Davis and Cannonball Adderley. But this was the first time I had heard message music so direct for my generation. The Freedom Now suite immediately raised my political, cultural consciousness. It wouldn't be until a year later that I would listen to John Coltrane's My Favorite Things and become a Trainite until Train passed on in 1967. As Ahmad explained, music was a powerful social force that opened new ways of looking and thinking about and even living in the world. Music is more, much more, than a commodity. Free jazz of that period represented quite simply freedom in breaking away from the restraints of the past. This power of music must be recaptured to become a resource for a people who are still not free. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu Jamal.
Let us ha, hey, hey, ho, 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 hard knock radio, east, west, north, south, conectados. Every set, every hood, barrio to barrio. Y'all stand up, stay righteous. Speaking to the thugs, one love. We know where y'all at. Top, Brown Buffalo. It's a hard knock life, gotta pay your bills. They want a song about bling, but it ain't real. We speak to the kids and the OGs. Organize, mobilize, be the change you wanna see. 415s bumping hard knock radio. Brown Buffalo, all up in your stereo. Yo, and to the youth, live life like it's golden. Go dumb, go hard, but don't forget where you're going. We from the hood, so it's all to the good. Let us know this, what you're feeling is right. Let's get this understood. It's only one reason why we here today. We trying to make real music so the people can relate.
Learning from these hard knocks, slipping in these hard knocks, listening to hard knocks, questioning the hard guy. Learning through these hard knocks, living for this hip hop, listening to hard knocks. Learning from the hard knocks, living in these hard knocks, listening to hard knocks, questioning the hard guy. Learning through these hard knocks, living for this hip hop, listening to hard knocks, rapping to the hard style.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
This is Bird Note. The month of April inspires poets, sometimes with contradictory results. T.S. Eliot describes April as the cruelest month, breeding lilacs out of the dead land. Shakespeare strikes an upbeat note, noting April hath put a spirit of youth in everything. Let's allow April, through the voice of nature, to speak for itself. Step outside and listen to the birds. In southeastern Alaska, the exuberant voice of a ruby-crowned kinglet rings from a streamside willow. In a Washington state marsh, a common yellowthroat perches atop a cattail as it belts out its galloping tune. In South Texas, the intricate musical phrasing of a long-billed thrasher rambles forth from a thicket. In a dense Midwestern shrub, a brown thrasher holds forth. The slender, secretive thrasher prefers singing from the shadows. From a nearby evergreen, come the pure whistled notes of a white-throated sparrow. This sweet music will ring through many northern forests all across the continent. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Session. Join us at the KBOO station on Friday,